Penguin Random House Audio presents The Panzer Killers, the untold story of a fighting general and his spearhead tank division's charge into the Third Reich, by Daniel P. Bolger. Read for you by Stephen Mendel. For Colonel Mark Axelberg, First Sergeant Danny Lackman, and Lieutenant Colonel Scott Rutter. He said unto his host, Fight this day for your brethren. 1 Maccabees, chapter 5, verse 32. Author's note. They're almost all gone now. I remember them well. When I was growing up, many of the neighborhood adults fought in World War II. The man across the street served as a Marine on Iwo Jima. A girl's father, two doors down, flew as a gunner on bombers launching out of England, and he brought home a wife from that green island. Her lilting accent provided endless fascination. My own dad was one of the younger ones. He'd fought in Korea as an infantry sergeant. When it came my time to join the U.S. Army, my first division commander had been a draftee in World War II. In years to come, I met plenty of former privates, corporals, tech sergeants, staff sergeants, petty officers, chiefs, and junior officers. As for Second World War generals, well, I'd seen Patton, watched the world at war, and read all the books, but I'd never met a general. That changed when I went to the Citadel, a state military college in Charleston, South Carolina. In 1977 or 1978, can't recall the exact date, but it was during my senior year, I received an opportunity to meet a former Citadel president, four-star General Mark W. Clark, West Point class of April 1917, veteran of World War I, World War II, and Korea, and best known for his command of the Fifth Army in the brutal Italian campaign of 1943 to 1945. Prime Minister Winston L.S. Churchill called Clark the American Eagle. Even in his dotage, you could tell this man had been a general commanding hundreds of thousands of soldiers. He radiated authority. Three cadets went to see Clark. A faculty officer, a Marine veteran of Vietnam, gave us ground rules. The general will talk, you'll listen. If you get to ask a question, be careful. Do not mention Salerno, the Rapido River, Casino, or Anzio. And above all, don't ask the general about his Jewish mother. His Jewish mother? I'd never read about that. Still, I'd been a cadet long enough to know how to keep my mouth shut. That I could do. When ushered in to meet Clark, we all stood at attention until the great man motioned us to sit. His wood-paneled study featured walls covered with plaques, maps, photographs, and mounted weapons, swords, bayonets, pistols, and rifles. Clark started speaking, low rumbling, all bass, no treble. He talked in measured phrases. Clark explained the difficult nature of Italian combat and the constant need to work with British allies. He liked the French mountain troops and thought a lot of the Canadians. The Poles fought bravely. Letting the Red Army take over their homeland, tragic, mused the general. As he described key maneuvers and former comrades, his eyes lit up. He'd been there and done that, as we say today. A cadet asked about Clark's work with General George C. Marshall, the U.S. Army Chief of Staff. In the summer of 1941, before Pearl Harbor, Marshall summoned Clark. One day, Clark offered, the chief said, Clark, I need the names of 100 officers fit to command divisions. Clark drew up that list. And he proudly remembered all the fine men he'd recommended, Eisenhower, Bradley, Patton, his classmates Collins and Ridgway, and all the rest. Before the country even joined the war, Clark knew who would command its forces in battle. He was one of them. A second cadet, not me, spoke up. He ventured a bit outside the lines. Was there anyone you did not name that turned out to be a good commander? Clark paused. He steepled his long fingers. Then he answered, Maurice Rose. I'd never heard of him, but then again, what did I know? Clark continued. He was outstanding, Clark said. Top Armored Division commander. Very brave. The Germans killed him right near the end of the war. Clark then moved on to other matters. I never did ask him anything. Don't miss a chance to say nothing, I guess. Spurred by Clark's comment, I determined to learn about this Maurice Rose. I found out some things back in 1977-1978. Then real life and my own military service got in the way. In the 4 decades plus that followed, I also commanded an armored division in combat. Lately, though, I've been learning a lot more about Maurice Rose. There's a reason General Clark said his name. Prologue. 40 ans, D plus 7. He who has not fought the Germans does not know war, British Army saying. It was the hinge of the whole beachhead, and the Germans knew it. They had a nose for such things, a kind of predatory sense that led them right to weak spots and gaps and cracks. Well, the little Normandy town of Carentan amounted to all of those. Hit it and drive to the sea. That would split off the American landing forces at Utah Beach from those at Omaha Beach. And it just might unravel the entire Allied assault on Adolf Hitler's vaunted Atlantic Wall. The Americans had landed 219,290 troops and 26,434 vehicles in the first week ashore. To their east, the British, Canadians, and a few Free French combined to field similar numbers. Off the American beaches steamed dozens of warships, including the great gray battleships USS Arkansas, USS Texas, and USS Nevada. Overhead flew hundreds of bombers and fighters, and yet somehow, as usual in every war, including the greatest of all, the locus of maximum crisis at Carentan came down to a few hundred dirty, tired young Americans with hand weapons. The Germans knew that as well. Maybe not the average privates. As in the Allied armies, the junior rankers had a lot to learn. Many of the German rank and file were nervous teenagers and glum middle-agers who'd never fired a rifle except on a range. But leading them were enough cagey veterans, quick-thinking officers, and hard-eyed sergeants who'd mastered their bitter trade on the Russian front. That battle-wise cadre knew the deal, and the deal was to blow away the thin line of Americans, smash through at Carentan, and reach the English Channel. Leading the way, as usual, would be the German tanks, the deadly panzers, a term well known to both sides and drawn from the official designation Panzerkampfwagen, armored battle vehicle. The Germans named their latest panzers for the great hunting cats, panthers and tigers. But all of them, the new and the old, the big, 49 to 77 tons, and the mid-sized, 25 to 30 tons, existed to crush and kill. Panzer cannons punched smoking holes through bunkers, buildings, and opposing tanks. Panzer machine guns tore apart trees, sandbags, thin-skinned trucks, and men unlucky enough to face that lethal stream of hot bullets. Worst of all, panzers bowled right ahead through mud, asphalt, rock, barbed wire, foxholes, with or without men in them, churning away with steel treads. Bullets and shell bursts might well kill you. A tank could smear you into the dirt. What remained wouldn't look human. Panzers didn't just slay men. The driving German tanks stunned them, unmanned them, and turned their guts to water. Early in the war, troops facing panzers broke and ran in Poland, France.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?